Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting of the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee will come to order. Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Houseman?
Present.
Howard?
Present.
Tice?
Present.
Egbadje?
Present.
Bliss?
Present.
Gomez?
Present.
Hassan? Hassan? Heinrich?
Present.
Herr?
Present.
Juergens?
Juergens, present.
Olson?
Present.
Farr? Farr? Ryer?
Present.
And then, let's see. Representative Farr?
Here.
Thank you. Madam Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you. Next order of business is approval of the minutes from Thursday, February 18th. Representative Howard, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, so moved.
Representative Howard moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? If not, members, unmute yourselves for a voice vote. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. We have House File 112, Representative Bernardi's bill up today. I will move that House File 112 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce, Finance, and Policy. Representative Bernardi, welcome to the committee, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's an honor to be here today. The bill before you repeals the current notice to residents and others when a manufactured home park owner is planning to offer the park for sale and replaces it with a new section providing additional notice and offer requirements. It accomplishes two goals. First, it requires people who own manufactured home parks to tell the park's resident homeowners if they're planning to sell. Second, it gives homeowners 60 days to put together an offer to buy the park. That is it. It doesn't require park owners to sell to the homeowners. It simply makes homeowners aware that the land their home sits on is on the market, and it provides them a short time frame for those homeowners to develop a bid for the park's owner's consideration. If park owners reject the homeowner's bid, they let the homeowners know within 5 days. If the park owners accept the homeowner's bid, the property must continue to be affordable housing for at least the next 50 years. Although manufactured home parks are affordable places to live, that affordability comes with significant risk. Park residents own their homes, but not the land under their home. The bill offers owners of these homes the opportunity to join with at least 51% of their homeowners to put an offer on the land that's for sale. There are currently 900 manufactured home parks across the state of Minnesota, and they're a home to more than 180 Minnesotans. Just over 9 of those communities are owned by the residents, representing 700 home sites. Increasingly, parks are being bought out by out-of-state investor buyers. Last year alone, 862 manufactured home sites were sold. 70% of those were sold to out-of-state buyers. With each year that passes, more and more parks are sold to out-of-state investors. Minnesota is losing the affordable housing at an alarming rate. We lose an average of 100 homes sites per year. The last new park community to open in the Twin Cities was in 1990. When a park closes, most homes are lost. Many homes can't be moved, or they are too old to be accepted by another park. Finally, I need to take a moment to make sure we all understand that this bill does not force a landowner to sell to residents, nor would it lower the sale price of the park. I just want to reiterate that this bill does not force the landowner to sell the park. With me today is the president of Park Plaza, which is in my own community, made up of 88 homeowners are the number of sites that are on. And I will let her talk more about our park and the importance of this bill. And with us today is Madam Chair, is Natividad Seafelt.
Natividad Seafelt, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. Do we have her on mute?
It appears she is muted at the moment.
There we go.
Okay.
Oh my goodness sakes.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Natividad Seafelt. Good morning, Representative Hausman and members of the Housing Finance and Policy Committee. I thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Natividad Seafelt. I own a home in the city of Fridley in Park Plaza Cooperative, a resident-owned manufactured home community. Our cooperative is home to 83 families, all ages and all backgrounds. I'm fortunate to live in one of Minnesota's 9 resident-owned communities. I am the current president on the board, and we have been a resident-owned community since February 15, 2011. And yes, that makes us 10 years old this month. Before 2011, I had to live with the same uncertainty that 45,000 Minnesota families face every day. Is this the day I receive the notice that I have to move because the community is being closed? Is this the day my family finds out we are forced to leave our home, jobs, family, and friends? Or will it be like many other days, a day where my neighbors and I keep asking for repairs and improvements and never anything happens? A day where community rules are unfairly applied? A day when rent gets raised on a whim at least twice a year? But for me, today, everything is different. I do not fear losing my home. My neighbors and I make improvements to our homes, knowing that it's an investment we won't lose due to decisions someone else makes for us. We also welcome new people into our community, and they are relieved to move into the community where they can feel secure. My household budget also feels more manageable. I know that land rent will only go up if the cost of managing the community increases beyond what the community has already planned for. We are proud of the fact that we manage the community well and have had no significant rent increases in the past 10 years. It's also important to know we improve our community. We added a playground, replaced utility systems, added more lighting, added readable water meters, added fire hydrants, of which we did not have before, added new roads, and even built a new storm shelter and community building. All of this while making sure we didn't raise the rent much. Buying the community wasn't easy. It was a long, hard, nerve-wracking process for the residents. It would have been easier with the type of policies proposed today in House File 112. In closing, I know the other residents of Park Plaza sleep better at night knowing our community is ours. I ask that Minnesota legislator to make it easier for other residents to preserve their communities as well. This is my hope and dream for all manufactured home communities. And I thank you very much for having me today.
Thank you for your testimony. We're joined by Dave Anderson from All Parks Alliance for Change. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Dave Anderson. I'm the Executive Director of All Parks Alliance for Change, which is a statewide association of manufactured homeowners. And I speak today in favor of the proposal introduced by Representative Bernardi, House File 112. I won't speak for very long. It's a simple proposal. It requires notice, but it doesn't require selling to the residents or accepting a lower price. It has bipartisan support with the introduction now in the Senate as well by Senator Housley. And it has broad support within the affordable housing community. It's one of the issues prioritized for this session by the Homes for All Coalition. And I do want to just very quickly mention, it's a proposal that's worked very smoothly in other states, including New Hampshire, which has had a policy like this for over 30 years. So it's an important idea, but it's not a new idea. And I ask the committee's support. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And we're now joined by Mark Brunner. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, thanks. Mark Brunner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you, Representative Bernardi, for an opportunity to visit last week and express some of our concerns that we have with the bill. We believe that that it's a solution in search of a problem, as it eliminates fundamental property rights for nearly 1,000 of Minnesota's largest providers of non-subsidized workforce affordable housing. Minnesota is currently recognized as one of the top states in the nation in providing residents of manufactured home communities an equal opportunity and protection to purchase their community when it's offered for sale or sold for redevelopment, exceeding protections in states such as Florida, Arizona, California, all of which have far more community residents as a percentage of their overall populations. For example, currently Minnesota requires what's called a notice of sale is provided by the community owner if they're selling their community and advertising it for sale through a publication, newspaper, real estate broker, by giving notice to all residents in the community. The intent of the statute is to give residents or a resident organization the opportunity to make an offer to the owner of the community, since they obviously have an interest in selling the property. Minnesota's current statute has worked well in allowing the conversion of several privately owned communities, as were mentioned previously, and converting them to cooperative ownership. In all of these ownership conversions, the residents and the resident organization worked with the community owner to negotiate a purchase price and successfully transfer ownership. Some of my members were some of the first to sell their properties to residents for a cooperative conversion under the existing statute. There's not an adversarial relationship in play. It's simply a willing seller and a willing buyer coming together, and that's how the market works. However, if the bill became law, it would discourage new development, expansion, and investments in upgrading existing infrastructure by owners of manufactured home communities. It sets up a litigious process for essentially the benefit of a handful of perhaps large nonprofit buyers at the expense of nearly 1,000 privately owned community owners by them surrendering property rights. The bill takes away a fundamental real estate property right, for example, to grant a first option to purchase, resulting in a loss of income. It takes away the property right of a community owner to bundle or package more than one property they may own when selling or receiving an unsolicited offer. In some cases, the community owner may have other entities that are part of a package that they're trying to sell, such as an adjacent mini storage business, a sales center, or even multifamily apartments that may be near the property. It takes away the rights of a property owner to sell their property without first giving concurrent legal notice to the state of Minnesota and every member of a household in a community. And based on the current definition, that means minor children, by certified mail that includes the price, terms, and conditions of an offer they have received to sell or transfer ownership of their property. We're not aware of any other property class in the state that has this requirement imposed on them. It fails to address a common real estate sales process where there are multiple offers. And these constantly change during negotiations. So there may be more than one potential buyer, and the property owners in negotiations, and the bill would require the owner then to continually notify the resident group of what's transpiring with the various negotiations going on. It takes away the property right of a community owner to accept an offer to lease, sell, or transfer ownership of their property for 60 days as a part of the notice requirement. And it further requires, if a community owner rejects the offer from a representative of the organization, that yes, they must provide written notice and the reasons why they rejected the offer by certified mail within 5 days to the resident organization, and then they must wait an additional 31 days before they could execute a purchase agreement. So we've gone from an already 60-day delay to now a 91-day delay in their ability to sell their property. There are no protections for the community who negotiates in good faith and then rejects the offer that they won't face legal challenges, alleging non-compliance, perhaps with some of the provisions in the bill, delaying a sale even further. It actually eliminates, and this is interesting, one of the hard-fought rights and protections of residents currently in 327C095 sub 6, such that when a nonprofit representative purchases a community that's closing, they need to certify to the Commissioner of Commerce that the property will be preserved as a manufactured home park for at least 10 years from the date of sale. And this is language that was added as recently as 2019. In the bill in subdivision 7, it eliminates the requirement that a nonprofit or representative continue to operate the manufactured home park as a manufactured home park community, and instead shifts it to saying that it needs to remain for 50 years, you know, one of other possible uses, such as a one family, two family, or a multifamily dwelling use for affordable housing. So that's a significant change in essentially allowing somebody to come in with this first right of purchase and then to actually convert the use. Whereas current law wouldn't permit that if exercising the right of first refusal that exists. So the other concern we have is that it doesn't specifically say that in making this change of use to perhaps multifamily, that approval is required by the municipality for zoning and changes so that you could exercise the right of first purchase and then proceed to the municipality to try to change use, and then the municipality, could deny it. And I'm not sure where that leaves the sale or transaction then. So it's just, one other hitch that's problematic. And as I mentioned previously, we're recognized in Minnesota as a national leader in allowing the conversion of privately owned properties to cooperative use. And so essentially what the bill does and concerns us most is eliminates property rights and will create uncertainty amongst owners of manufactured home communities in terms of investing and going forward in making upgrades to their community if in fact they lose their fundamental property right to sell their property. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. This does go on to the Commerce Committee, so that there will be another committee discussion about this. We're joined by Michelle Carlson from Ives Realty. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Hausman and committee members, thank you so very much for allowing me to speak. My name is Michelle Carlson. I'm a second generation manufactured home community owner and a licensed real estate broker. I live in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. I've worked for the last 25 years in manufactured housing. I specialize in manufactured housing property management, and I'm an active voice in affordable housing as part of the MMHA board, the Habitat, my local Habitat for Humanity board, and also my local chamber. I oversee and own 1,200 plus home sites in 6 manufactured home communities located in both the metro area and rural Minnesota. I was raised in manufactured housing just north of St. Cloud, and my first home purchase was a manufactured home in Duluth. My mission as a manufactured home community owner is to provide the same sense of neighborhood that to my residents that I felt when I was growing up. As mentioned, we have communities throughout Minnesota, but one of the largest is Zenith Terrace in Duluth. It's a beautiful community, one of the finest in northern Minnesota with over 500 home sites. We've owned this property since 1981, and that is 40 years this year. The community has seen 6 expansions, adding over 200 home sites with ongoing upgrades in electrical, gas infrastructure, street overlays, installation of off-street parking, newer playgrounds, bus stops, and so much more to beautify this community. In all of the communities we own, we have professional management teams that are on site to assist our residents. We have strong customer support. We organize social gatherings for our communities and certainly ensure that our communities are top-notch and looking great. We like to have added value to our residents' living experience and a neighborhood that our residents are proud to call home. Many of my residents have lived with us for 10 plus years, some even 20 years. They've raised their families and now their children are purchasing homes within our community. A lot of pride of ownership. And there are certainly, these are homeowners with choice. They could choose any type of housing, but they are choosing manufactured housing in a land lease community. I have real concerns with this House File 112 as a community owner and in the ability to maintain the ability to sell my communities in the future. These are assets that I have continually developed and invested in, and it has been my livelihood for 25 years. This bill takes away a fundamental real estate property right of a manufactured home community to grant a right of first option to purchase. And it is giving it to a nonprofit buyer, resulting in a significant loss of income without just compensation. It also takes away property rights for me to be able to package not only my community, but also perhaps my mini storage or my sales center together in a sale. It does diminish my property values. It will easily delay a sale for 6 months and perhaps even deter a sale completely. And this is, you know, what buyer is going to wait around for 6 months knowing whether or not they have the ability to continue with the sale? I doubt I can do it without court action. And that's not fair. It's a taking of property rights. We also, you know, in my neighborhood, we have cooperatives, grocery cooperatives, and we have like senior apartment cooperatives, but neither of these cooperatives have, such as we have, a right of first opportunity to purchase, which delays them. So why are manufactured home communities being singled out? I'm a licensed real estate broker. Certainly I get phone calls from potential people who wish to purchase our communities. And the advocates have the same right to come to a private home community owner to offer an option to purchase, but it's what you're offering is not a level playing field. It's giving nonprofits that ability to have that first option without compensation to me. I hope to continue to offer good, clean, affordable community lifestyle to my residents. And I want to do that well. I can say that with this becoming law, it will be very difficult for me to continue doing business in Minnesota when I have other states surrounding who do not have this first opportunity to purchase law. Thank you for the opportunity to talk. I would say I wish I could say that this bill needs a little bit of work, but honestly, it is foundationally flawed. And it does take away my property rights. You know, with over 1,000 privately owned communities in the state, we are the biggest advocates of manufactured housing and hope to continue to be. Thank you, Chair and committee members.
Thank you for your testimony. And we're joined now by Paul, is it Eager or Aker, Minnesota Realtors. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Aker, and I am Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Minnesota Realtors is a statewide business trade association with a membership of over 21,000 real estate professionals working with buyers and sellers of all types of property in every corner of the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding our concerns with House File 112, which I also shared with Representative Bernardi via email last Friday. Mr. Bruner and Ms. Carlson both did a great job of describing some of the specific issues with the bill, so I will be very brief. We have two primary concerns with House File 112. First, Minnesota Realtors supports policies that recognize and protect the right to own, use, and transfer real property. One of the fundamental rights of any property owner is the ability to freely market and sell his or her property without unreasonable restrictions. An owner of any property, including a manufactured home park, may have numerous business and/or personal reasons for deciding to sell a property and then when to put that property on the market. By creating this opportunity to purchase process, House File 112 would substantially interfere with this important property right. On the purchase side, as you just heard from Ms. Carlson, residents are already free to put in an offer on any park when the property goes on the market. In fact, for manufactured home parks, current law even includes a notice of sale provision, which Mr. Bruner referenced in his testimony. The second concern we have is Minnesota Realtors opposes policies that adversely affect the timeliness of the real estate transaction. The opportunity to purchase process in House File 112 represents a delay in the market time of the property of at least 91 days if the owner does not accept the offer submitted by the residents. Meanwhile, there may be potential buyers with the resources to purchase and invest in the property, but who are not willing or able to wait out the delay mandated by this bill. Madam Chair, thank you again for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. Now, Mr. Wirth, do we have questions for members?
Yes, Madam Chair. First on the list is Representative Bliss.
Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the author, you know, at first blush, the way you described it, it sounded relatively reasonable, but when we started discussing it, I have some questions. Recently, a mobile home park sold in Bemidji. It wasn't necessarily in an industrial park area, but it was adjacent to it. And I'm wondering, with a 50-year commitment to keeping it as affordable housing, does that take into account any kind of zoning changes the city might put in that area? Again, this was just adjacent to an industrial park.
So Bernardi, we could also have Mr. Anderson available for questions too, I think, right? Do you want to take that, or would you like Mr. Anderson to?
Mr. Anderson would be fine.
Mr. Anderson.
Well, and that, thank you for the question, Representative. That was one of the reasons to build in some flexibility with the longer time frame of 50 years as opposed to the 10 years, which isn't rescinded but applies to another section of the law having to do with exercise of the right of first refusal, which is a different right and a different time frame. Imagining that over a longer period of time, 50 years as opposed to 10 years, that there may need to be some flexibility in terms of how affordable housing is provided on that site. That's why additional options are listed. I'd like to think we could all predict where things would be in 50 years, but if I could, I would be an extremely wealthy man.
Follow up, Representative Bliss?
Author or somebody else, do you know of any other law in the state of Minnesota that requires a 50-year commitment after purchasing land?
Mr. Anderson, I don't know whether you'd be in a position to, we might have to go to a researcher for an answer to that.
Chair, Representative, that's, yes, I would have to look into that.
Yeah, sorry, Madam Chair.
Representative Bliss.
I seriously doubt you're going to find another law in the state of Minnesota with that kind of a commitment. That's just, I couldn't imagine there being another law like that. I do have another question. So, Representative Bernardi, you stated there's no requirement to sell to the offering nonprofit or residents. But if, for instance, if you got two identical offers, one was from a commercial bidder and the other was from the residents, identical price, and the owner of the land decided to sell to the commercial purchaser, you say there's no requirement to sell to the community. Why then is there a 31-day wait time between when you accept the other offer and you can, is that for the community to get a lawyer to file charges or file some sort of action against the seller? What is that 30 days for? What's that wait for?
Mr. Anderson or Representative Bernardi?
Mr. Anderson, I'll let you take that.
The 31 days was just to ensure that there was spacing in between an offer being declined and a final purchase offer being signed. If the offers are identical, it would be entirely up to the seller to determine which offer that they wanted to go with. It was just in order to insert a period of time to make sure that things were properly sequenced in terms of declining an offer, signing a purchase agreement.
Well, Madam Chair, let's say that the community member offered $1,000 more, but the commercial provider or the seller thought the commercial provider had a better solution for the area. It's his land. Can he do that?
Mr. Anderson.
Representative, the decision on what party to sell to always resides with the seller. It's simply an opportunity to put in an offer and to receive notice in order to put in an offer, but a resident offer doesn't trump other offers. It's ultimately the choice of the seller.
Representative Bliss.
Just one more. I'm sorry, guys. One final question. I don't understand the 31-day wait. If you decide to take an offer, why can't you take the offer and sell it? Extending the sale for another 31 days, that could make or break a deal. This is private property. I don't understand why we have to wait 31 days. If we've notified the community, they put in an offer, the seller decided he doesn't want to sell it to the community for whatever reason, why the wait? Why the 31-day wait? Why can't we go move forward with the sale at that point?
Mr. Anderson.
Chair, Representative, that's certainly an issue that could be revisited in the proposal. Like I said, the intention was just to make sure that things were sequenced properly, an offer from the residents was declined for whatever reason that the seller decided to decline the offer, and that's entirely up to them to decide what that reason might be. But just to ensure that occurs before a purchase offer is entered into, but the exact time frame is certainly something that could be revisited in the proposal.
Mr. Wirth, do we have other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair. Next on the list is Representative Howard.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple questions. And this is either for the bill author or for the testifiers. It was referenced that, I think by Mr. Bruner, that there's no other property class that is treated this way in law. But I'm curious, are there any other property classes where someone owns the structure, but not the land, in which a sale would actually displace the owner of that structure?
Mr. Anderson.
This is, thank you, Chair, Representative. This is certainly a unique circumstance with two sets of ownership rights. Certainly from our perspective, we see that as a strong argument for looking for some kind of reasonable notice and some kind of opportunity to purchase in order to achieve a bit of a balance, even though ultimately it would still be on the seller to determine who they would want to sell to.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think that's a really important point for us to consider as we're debating this. You know, this isn't, we're not talking about somebody selling an office building. We're talking about selling homes where people live. And as the testifier mentioned, that their decision of whether to sell or not is still going to rest with the owner. Another question, one point was brought up that this would limit the ability to sort of sell if an owner owns multiple manufactured home parks and packages them together, that would limit this. That, to me, that actually was a red flag that, if a single owner owned multiple parks all over the state, in short order, they could displace a lot of people real quick. And so I'm curious, does anyone have any data about home ownership of parks, or are there single owners that own and operate a multiple array of parks all over the state, or is it often that one owner owns one park?
Mr. Anderson.
There are still what are referred to as mom and pop owners, single property ownership along the lines of what you're describing. But certainly for decades now, we've seen a process of consolidation. And as Representative Bernardi mentioned in presenting the proposal, we've seen an increase in consolidation of ownership, including among national companies and national chains, that I believe the figure was that 70% of the home sites that sold last year sold to national consolidators. So there is still mom and pop ownership, but it's a decreasing segment of the ownership.
Representative Howard.
Just one more question, Madam Chair. Mr. Bruner mentioned that there is a public notice requirement for local newspaper. I'm just curious, is that the extent of it, that there's a notification that has to be made in the local newspaper? And I'm curious what the timing elements are of that public notice in terms of when that is notice is required before a sale.
Representative Anderson, otherwise, I don't know if we have a nonpartisan researcher on the call for some of these technical questions. Just alert us if you have an answer from nonpartisan research. Otherwise, Mr. Anderson.
The current notice requirement, the requirement that's being repealed, is a requirement only to provide notice if officially listed using a realtor. And based on our review of sales over the last 5 years, that seems to be an extremely rare approach to selling the properties that overwhelmingly the sales are made without any kind of formal listing of the property, in which case that notice requirement is never required, never goes into effect, and residents aren't made aware that the property is on the market.
So, Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All this is helpful. One just final comment. I worked a little bit in this space over the last 2 years on my camera fell over there. The right of first refusal. And there was a lot of technical issues there, and I was really grateful for the stakeholders on all sides working together on that. And so to me, this seems like an area where I really see a value in this approach, and hope that stakeholders can continue to work together and see if we can find a path forward. Thanks, Madam Chair.
And Representative Howard, this was a new area to me, but as I'm listening to this, I'm realizing this is really selling the land out from under a house. And that's the sort of unusual nature of this and the risk that a homeowner is put in. Mr. Wirth, who's next?
Madam Chair, two more questions. Representative Farr, followed by Representative Heinrich.
Farr, you said?
Yes, Representative Farr.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, so maybe a question that I'll piggyback on Representative Howard's comments there. So at the end of the day, yes, we're selling property under a home, but if you're the owner of that property, you're selling an asset. So my question is there any other law where we require a person selling an asset in the state to give a right of first option to someone else? Anywhere else do we do that?
I don't know, Mr. Anderson, if you have an answer to that. I'm still wondering if we have a nonpartisan researcher who might also. Mr. Anderson.
Chair, Representative, I don't have a specific answer to your question.
The unusual thing is it's not often, I would think, that you sell land out from under a house. So right. It is a really unique situation like that.
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, Madam Chair, and understood, and I think, you know, but to that owner, it's an asset that they're trying to sell, and so I struggle with, if we don't do that anywhere else in state law, should we be doing it here? Secondly, just maybe a comment on the 50-year commitment. I think that that's going to hurt the potential of those owners buying the property, because as a lender, if that's all that you can do with that property, that's going to be taken into account when they're going to try and get a loan. That's what it has to be for 50 years. As a lender, I'm looking at highest and best use of that, as should the owner, I think. And so I think that 50-year commitment could actually hamper the ability for owners to go and buy their own mobile home park. So just a thought there from a personal perspective. Madam Chair, that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. One more, Mr. Worth.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Heinrich.
Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question for either Mr. Anderson or Representative Bernardi. I'm not sure who best to answer it. I understand the intention in doing this for residents, but you're also specifically cutting in nonprofits and into the language, and nonprofits who claim to work for the residents. Doesn't that give nonprofits a kind of an unfair advantage? And what is the, ownership stake that a resident could end up with? My guess would be maybe a few hundred dollars in equity. And so doesn't this just give a nonprofit a unfair advantage against a private investor? I guess that's my first question, Madam Chair.
Mr. Anderson.
Chair, Representative. As I said, it's just notice to put in an offer that doesn't have to be accepted. And even then, the offer can only be submitted if it has the support of 51% of the resident homeowners. So it's something that can only be exercised as an option for the residents themselves. So it would have to be an organized group of residents that would be interested in doing this. It does allow for them to work with a nonprofit. I can say that in terms of the nine communities that have become resident-owned park cooperatives in the state, all of those have resulted in communities directly owned by the residents through a cooperative model. So I would certainly imagine that residents exercising that level of support for submitting an offer would be interested in retaining ownership of the community.
Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that, Mr. Anderson. It certainly does concern me, though, that this bill would take away valuable property rights from owners. Fortunately, I'm certain this bill has no chance of moving in the Senate. I'm happy for that. I think a group of residents or a resident already has the ability to buy a park on the open market. I am also concerned over the 60 to 90 day waiting period. A lot of people have mentioned the 50-year mandate, but the 60 to 90 day waiting period concerns me. When you talk about an investor, that investment capital could go somewhere else in that time period, jeopardizing the whole process if the group of people, the people that are living at the park can't get their act together and get an offer in on time. So this bill has a bunch of issues for me. I'm going to be a no today. And like I said, I'm thankful that I don't think it has any chance of passing the Senate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Worth, any other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Howard has his hand up.
Representative, I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Representative Howard.
Representative Howard.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I just had one clarifying question related to the Senate. Could Representative Bernardi share, is this bill authored? What does the authorship look like in the Senate on this bill? I understood that there was some bipartisan support for this, and so just wanted to get that on the record.
Representative Bernardi?
Representative Housley is the chief author in the Senate, and Senator Housley and Senator Matthews has also signed on, and they both represent the Republican Party.
So Senator Housley is the Senate chief author. Representative Howard?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I'm a little more optimistic about our path to getting this accomplished. So
thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Okay, no further questions. Representative Bernardi, do you have any final comments?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I saw that there was some a little bit confusion with the right of first refusal bill. And that law says that when a park is being sold for redevelopment, residents may match the developer's offer for the land in order to keep their community open. This bill does not force a landowner to sell to the residents. And I just want to say House File 112 gives homeowners the opportunity to put in an offer to buy the land in which they live. It's an opportunity for these families and individuals to remain connected to their schools, jobs, and neighborhoods. Thank you for listening to this bill, and I appreciate your support in moving this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. I will renew my motion that House File 112 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce, Finance, and Policy. Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Houseman?
Aye.
Howard?
Aye.
Tice?
No.
Egbadje?
Aye.
Bliss?
No.
Gomez?
Aye.
Hassan?
Aye.
Heinrich?
No.
Herr?
Aye.
Jurgens?
No.
Olson?
Aye.
Barr?
No.
And Ryer?
Aye.
Madam Chair, that is 8 ayes and 5 nays.
There being 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. The bill is referred. And Representative Bernardi, you have a second bill, House File 896. I will move that House File 896 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you again for this opportunity to present this bill. This bill provides a process to affix a manufactured home to real property when that home is located, is owned by a nonprofit cooperative. This process allows the manufacturer home to be considered an improvement to real property and is no longer personal property. In Minnesota, manufactured homes are sited on rented land. In a manufactured mobile home park, are titled as chattel or personal property. The personal property designation of a manufactured home on rented land makes them ineligible for traditional mortgage financing. This bill allows homeowners who are members of a cooperative-owned manufacturing home park to title their homes as real property and gain access to more competitive home financing options. The bill has been developed in conjunction with the State Bar Association and titling industry, and has had a lot of people contribute and reviewed into this, not that they have actually signed off of it, but there's been a lot of conversation with including credit unions, community bankers, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. The legislation has also been reviewed by the Manufacturer Model Home Association. And I am not saying that there is 100% consensus, but I want to let you know that there is a dialogue in working towards having this bill supported by all these organizations. New manufactured homes are built to similar standards as stick-built homes. There are four manufactured home builders in Minnesota. Individuals who own a manufactured home and own the land under the home can obtain mortgage financing. Minnesota Housing provides mortgages to manufactured home buyers where the home is sited on owned land. There are 9 resident-owned cooperative communities in Minnesota with over 700 homes and 100 vacant lots. This legislation is designed specifically to assist those homeowners across the mortgage market by allowing homeowners in co-ops to title their homes as real property. This legislation does not require any financial institution, including Minnesota Housing, to provide a mortgage, but eliminates a major obstacle to financing by allowing the home to be titled as real property. The handout that someone has sent out today in the packet indicates that saving homeowners could realize if able to purchase a home with traditional mortgage rather than personal property loan. This bill does not come up with the new products that will be sold, but it creates an opportunity for those types of packages to be created in the future. Currently, condominiums and housing cooperatives are financed through the traditional mortgage market. I believe this legislation will create a market that can assist low-income working families living in resident-owned co-ops purchase new homes. We have an affordable and workforce housing crisis in the state. We need to support efforts to improve manufactured home finance and make these already very affordable homes more accessible to our low and moderate income neighbors. Thank you very much for this opportunity to bring this bill before you.
And you have one testifier, Victoria Clark from the North Country Cooperative Foundation. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Victoria Clark. I'm the Executive Director at North Country Cooperative Foundation and very happy to be with you today. And thank you to Representative Bernardi for that introduction of House File 896. I actually have a couple of slides because I'm a visual person. So I'm going to share my screen. And I think, can someone give me a thumbs up if they can see my slide
here? We can see it.
Okay, excellent. All right. So NCF has been active, NCF being North Country Cooperative Foundation, has been active in the manufactured housing sector since 2004. We work with the homeowners of manufactured home communities to convert their communities to cooperative ownership. And we also provide the ongoing post-purchase support to all of the co-ops that we help create so that they can be successful in the long term. To date, we've worked with 9 Minnesota manufactured home communities to convert to cooperative ownership. So over this long track record of working in this sector and working with owners of manufactured home communities, we've learned a lot about the unique challenges that face owners of manufactured home parks. And chief among these concerns and challenges is increasing physical vacancy. And this is a concern not only for our resident-owned communities, our co-ops that we work with, but for all park owners across the state. Across the 9 co-ops that we support through our that are considered our client co-ops, is how we refer to them, there's a little over 700 home sites. And of those 700 home sites, 100 are currently vacant, meaning that there's a licensed lot, there's a licensed site for a home to be placed, but there's no home on that site. And physical vacancy, as you can imagine, in these communities presents a major financial threat to the cooperative, who relies on the income that they generate from the monthly site rent fees that they charge to their members to cover the operating costs of the property. Every year, the 100 home sites, just to give you a sense of the dollars lost with these home sites that remain vacant, across these 100 home sites of our 9 communities in Minnesota, that's $400,000 in lost revenue across the co-ops that we support. And I'm looking at Natividad to nod as I say some of these things, because I know I've worked with Natividad over the years with Park Plaza as they struggle to fill their vacant lots. She knows this challenge very well. So increasing home vacancy in a community is largely due to the loss of older homes that, due to age and condition, have to be demolished. And when I say older home, I'm referring to those homes that predate the institution of the HUD code, or the 1976 National Manufactured Home Building Code. These homes are often referred to as pre-HUD homes. These homes tend to be at a greater risk for loss due to inadequate design, and often aren't good candidates for rehabilitation. And we actually recently surveyed all of our client communities and found that about 30% of all the homes in our client co-ops were built prior to 1976. So what we're looking at and forecasting is that we're going to see more and more homes that have to be demolished and removed from our client co-ops, and that poses an increasing financial threat. And also, on the flip side, an opportunity to fill those vacant lots with new energy efficient homes. So once a home site goes vacant, it's pretty difficult to get it filled, and not for the reasons that you might think. In fact, sourcing high-quality new manufactured homes is relatively easy, and new homes are available at a fraction of the cost of new stick-built homes in Minnesota. We have 4 excellent manufactured home builders in our state, and you can purchase a new energy-efficient 3-bed, 2-bath home from any one of these reputable builders for around $80,000. That's a rough kind of an approximate figure. I'm not citing an actual figure for one of these homes. No, in fact, the primary barrier to filling vacant lots in a manufactured home community has nothing to do with physically buying a home and affixing it to the land, and everything to do with how the home is able to be financed once it's in place. As Representative Bernardi mentioned, manufactured homes on rented land are titled as chattel property, also known as personal property. And this personal property designation bars homeowners from utilizing mortgage financing for their homes, and leaves them to navigate what is increasingly few loan products in the chattel lending world, as we call it, that are offered. So increasingly few products available for folks to finance new manufactured homes. In addition to increasingly few loan products that home buyers can access, the terms of these chattel loan products, these personal loan products, they pale in comparison to what you can get on the mortgage market. So we're talking loan terms of 5 to 15 years. I've seen them occasionally go up to 20 if you've got a really good credit score, and interest rates that are 3 to 5% higher than the going mortgage rate. And if your credit history has a little bit of fuzz on it, which many of the folks that are applying to finance homes and purchase homes in our client cooperatives, some of them have some fuzz on their credit ratings. These rates and terms, they get even less competitive. It gets harder and harder and less affordable the more challenging your own credit profile is. Every single co-op that we work with cites home financing as the primary barrier to filling vacant lots. And many of our co-ops, despite these challenges, they've undertaken home infill projects. They're constantly hustling to bring in new homes, find new buyers. So it's not for lack of trying, but it is a major hurdle. And what I hear folks in our co-ops refer to this when they're bringing in a new home and they're trying to find qualified buyers, is that it's a bit like finding a needle in a haystack. And for our communities that are in rural communities, where the median home value of a stick-built home is comparatively lower than what the going median home value is statewide, it makes it even more challenging. So our rural co-ops are even at an even greater disadvantage because of this chattel financing market than our co-ops in the metro. And I just to give you a little case study, again, I'm a visual learner. I wanted to give you a case study of our co-op that we support called Five Lakes Cooperative in Fairmont, Minnesota. Five Lakes has 39 vacant lots in their co-op, which equates to about $100,000 in lost revenue annually. And also an opportunity, again, an opportunity to fill 39 vacant lots with new high quality homes and put 39 families in home ownership opportunity. So this chart kind of gives you an idea of, you know, a stick built median home value in Fairmont, Minnesota, there in Martin County, is a little over $100,000 a year. So you're looking at a total monthly, if we make some assumptions, some general assumptions about what the mortgage, what type of mortgage financing you can get on that home, you're looking at all-in housing costs of $635. In that middle column, you see with a typical chattel financing, chattel product, you're looking at $200 more a month in housing costs. Not very competitive to purchase a new manufactured home in Five Lakes Cooperative with those types of lending options available to you. And then you see in the far right column, you know, if we can leverage some better, more competitive rates and terms, we make that home infinitely more affordable and accessible to folks with low and extremely low incomes. In fact, in a county like Martin County, where the 30% of area median income is $26,000 a year, you can make that home affordable to that buyer. So just to reiterate, House File 896 simply allows homeowners to title their home as real property if the homeowner can also demonstrate that they have security of land tenure by virtue of being a member of a nonprofit or co-op that owns the land on which the home is sited. The intent of this legislation, again, is to improve the home loan products that are available to manufactured homeowners, making an already affordable home option more accessible to lower income purchasers. And the intent of the legislation is to increase home production in the state as well. Again, you know, if we can get some better financing options, we've got 100 sites that are just ready to have new homes placed. And so it's good for our builders, our four builders in the state. And the triple win, the icing on the cake is that, you know, this type of this bill and the loan products that we can leverage as a result of it will increase the earned income for the co-ops that we support and allow them to keep their rents low. And by generating additional revenue, can continue to channel that earned income back into the properties that they are so proud to call home and proud to be owners of. I wanted to, just before I yield the floor to questions, I needed to make a correction to the handout that we submitted with this bill. We listed some organizations, so I understand that the original authors of the bill, Representative Salk and some members of our team had met with prior when drafting the legislation last year. They did not actually assist in the drafting of the bill, although they were consulted. So the groups consulting on the drafting of the legislation include the Manufactured and Modular Housing Association, the Minnesota Land Title Association, and the Real Property Division of the Bar Association. Want to make that important clarification. We did send a corrected handout to the committee administrator. And with that, I welcome any questions that folks have on the call.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Wirth. Do we have questions?
Madam Chair, giving it a minute. There are no questions at this time.
Okay. Very, very complete testimony. Representative Bernardi, do you have any final comments?
I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee and all of our testifiers today. We do have a crisis in people being able to have affordable housing for them and their families. And this is a bill to help to create more affordable housing opportunities for people to be able to live and grow in their communities and to be a part of a great neighborhood. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. This is House File 896 will be laid over for possible inclusion. And now we have House File 747, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
To get it before us, the chair moves that House File 747 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Hornstein, welcome back to the Housing Committee. We miss you so.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I miss the committee as well, but I'm able to participate in Chair Gomez's Preventing Homelessness Committee. So thank you so much for hearing this bill. And Madam Chair and members, we did hear this in 2019. And so the bill is back. And House File 747 has three general and basic goals. Number one, to limit displacement. Two, to enhance housing stability. And three, maximize public investments in affordable housing. And the bill does this simply by placing an expectation that in exchange for public investments in multifamily housing, in state-funded multifamily housing projects, those projects would then have to maintain affordability for a minimum of 30 years. And Madam Chair and members, I personally got very interested in this issue over 20 years ago, I think 23 years ago, when I was working for a nonprofit as a community organizer. And we were contacted by tenants in a large public building, actually that's now in the district that I represent, called Oak Grove Towers, 228 units of affordable housing. At that time, a developer wanted to convert that building into market rate housing. And I had a chance to get to know the tenants, who were very, very unnerved by this possibility. People who were many elderly, many immigrants, people with AIDS, so many folks that really literally had nowhere to go. And this was preserved partially as continued affordable housing by the organizing efforts of those tenants, many of whom had Section 8 vouchers. Some were in the Section 202 senior housing, federal senior housing program. And that experience really had an impact, not only on me personally, but many who worked on the issue, because we could really see very directly and very clearly what happens when these properties are converted, and how vulnerable those who are, need housing stability are often the most vulnerable in these situations. So we were able to preserve much of that building as affordable. It still is today, but we need legislation like this to prevent those actions from happening. And so I'll just say in conclusion, before I introduce a couple of testifiers, Madam Chair and members, that we need to make 30 years the standard for all existing and possible new funding sources for affordable housing. 30 years is that standard for many projects, but not all. And in this moment where we're in this continued housing crisis, this legislation will help ensure some stability and some certainty for buildings that are receiving public support from the state for affordable housing. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce the two testifiers, if that would be okay.
Yes, we have Carrie Johnson from the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers and also representing Homes for All. And I think she's going first, right?
Yes.
Ms. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Chair Hausman, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Johnson. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor at the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers, or MCCD. MCCD is an association of 50 nonprofit organizations committed to expanding the wealth and resources of communities through housing opportunities and economic development initiatives. MCCD's mission to build strong and stable communities can only be achieved by addressing the inequities that have shaped housing and economic development policies at every level of government, and that has prevented Black, Indigenous, and people of color from achieving housing stability, accessing capital, and wealth building opportunities. I also serve as a policy co-chair for the Homes for All Coalition, and I know at this point, all of you are pretty familiar with the coalition. I'd like to thank Representative Hornstein for carrying House File 747 again this biennium, and to the Governor of Minnesota Housing for supporting a version of this bill as well. As Representative Hornstein mentioned, the goal of this bill is to do a few things. One, clarify and statute what Minnesota Housing is largely already doing, along with setting the precedent that any new financing mechanisms be used to finance projects of at least 30 years, if not longer. Maximize the state's investments in affordable housing. This expands beyond competitive financing to include land, labor, and materials that are currently seen as a scarcity and could otherwise support permanent affordable housing for 30 years or longer. Prevent displacement. As we've heard from personal testimony earlier this session from Linda Soderstrom, displacement has far-reaching consequences that can last years and impact entire communities. And lastly, support permanent affordability. According to Minnesota Housing, new developments, affordable or market rate, will not become naturally occurring affordable housing until 40 years after they are developed. Affordable housing properties that are only affordable for 15 years are less likely to be able to keep serving lower income households without longer terms of financing or covenants. I acknowledge that enacting this policy change will mean that some companies in the affordable housing business will have to adjust their models. But ultimately, supporters see this policy change as necessary to make progress in combating our state's affordable housing crisis. I absolutely welcome conversations on the issue, so please feel free to reach out to me. My information is pretty easily found online. We are joined today by Barb Janetta with Alliance Housing. Like other MCCD nonprofit housing providers, Alliance Housing is committed to permanent affordable housing. They are a fixture in the communities in which they operate. Have worked for years to combat NIMBYism by getting to know their neighbors. They advocate for funding increases and policy changes with limited staff capacity. And last summer, Alliance Housing held an impromptu food and supply drive after the civil unrest at their permanently affordable East Lake Street property. Thank you, Barb, for all that you do. Thank you to the committee.
Ms. Janetta, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Representative Houseman and committee members, for the opportunity to make a few comments today. I'm Barb Janetta, and I'm the Executive Director of Alliance Housing. We're a nonprofit housing developer and manager in Minneapolis. We own and operate about 500 rental apartments focused on the lowest wage workers and lowest income households, many who need a second chance at accessing stable housing. So far this session, you've heard a lot about Minnesota's affordable housing crisis. While increased funding to help meet the housing needs of our communities is crucial to combat the crisis, implementing House File 747 would help maximize current and future housing investments. This bill would require a minimum of 30 years of affordability in exchange for state investments in multifamily housing projects. The goal is to help combat and prevent displacement, stabilize our state's affordable housing market, and maximize the state's financial resources. The policy issue has been talked about for a number of years by nonprofit affordable housing developers as resources continue to be limited and our affordable housing crisis grows. Many nonprofit developers like Alliance already keep affordable housing units permanently affordable for the life of the property. Many times this is much longer than 30 years. This bill, in tandem with sustainable funding, will help support the affordable housing in communities across the state for the long term. Currently, most of the funding sources administered through Minnesota Housing already require 30 years of affordability, and preference is given to projects with even longer affordability terms. However, many, if not all, of the state's financial tools to produce and preserve affordable housing are heavily oversubscribed and very competitive. The process for acquiring governmental capital is competitive, and there are many of us who are committed to long-term affordability, 30 to 40 and plus years. This resource is just too scarce to let for-profit developers turn government capital into profit exchange for only 15 years of affordability. If funding mechanisms can't be adjusted to accommodate 30 years, there should be covenants on the land at least for 30 years. Given the fact that government capital is constrained and insufficient to meet demand, it's imperative that funding awarded of any kind guarantee affordability as long as possible. The state shouldn't be in the business of funding assets for private owners who have no mission of owning and managing affordable housing long term. I know lawmakers like to hear directly from people that have or would benefit from the investments. Even before the pandemic, it was difficult for our tenants to miss work to testify. But I have a short story and then I'll conclude about one of our tenants who lived at Hiawatha Commons for 9 years. Renisha moved in when she was 18 years old and pregnant with her first child. She'd been living with her parents. Since this was her first move, she really had no rental history, no record of responsibility. But despite her lack of history, we gave her a second chance. She moved into a studio apartment, but continued to expand her living space as her family grew. She shared a two-bedroom with her husband and three children, before she moved out into a market rate apartment. She credits the property manager, the site manager at the property, with helping her through lots of her life transitions. She said, "Eric is the best. I can talk with her about anything. Her door is always open. Her alliance living experience has shaped and molded me, and I've grown in the areas of responsibility, finance, and money management." So oftentimes, affordability for the long term and giving someone a second chance to access that affordability really helps them get set up for the future and not being dependent on affordable units. So thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you to the two testifiers. Mr. Wirth, do we have questions for members?
Madam Chair, there are no questions at this time.
There are no questions. Representative Hornstein, do you have some closing comments?
Madam Chair, Representative Juergens just raised
the hand. Oh, Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Owen, for catching that. I was late raising my hand. I just have a clarification question for the bill author. My understanding of this is that it is not retroactive to developments that have already taken place, but it would only affect the developments moving forward from the enactment date. Is that correct,
Representative Hornstein?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Representative Juergens, that is my understanding, but I will defer also to the testifiers just to confirm that.
Ms. Johnson or Ms. Janetta, either of you have a different point of view?
Chair Hausman, Representative Juergens, Carrie Johnson, your interpretation is correct. This bill is forward-looking, not backward-looking.
Okay, thank you.
Juergens, follow-up? Okay.
No follow-up.
Any further? Mr. Wirth, any others? No, Representative
Hornstein. Nothing else at this time.
Representative Hornstein, closing, final comments.
Madam Chair and members, thank you so much. Thank you to Ms. Johnson and Ms. Janetta. This is, again, I think a very, very critical part of our overall housing strategy, which is to, in fact, prevent displacement. I think that is the main goal here, and to make sure that we have long-term affordability for our state investment. So, Madam Chair, thank you so much for hearing this bill, and appreciate the committee support.
Okay, thank you. And the House File 747 will be laid over for possible inclusion. I think there
thank
is
you,
no.
Yes,
thank you. There being no other business before us, the next meeting of the Housing Finance and Policy Committee will be on Thursday, February 25 at 10:30. We are adjourned.